Hi, I'm Sam Seder. This week on Ring of Fire, David Dayen from the American Prospect will join us to discuss the day one agenda. Over 30 important executive actions Joe Biden can take without an ounce of approval from Mitch McConnell. And Heather Digby Parton will help me run through another crazy week in the news. If you're listening to the free podcast right now, do us a favor and support the show. You can help us out by becoming a member over at ROFpodcast.com. Here to break down this week's news, Heather Digby Parton from Salon and the popular blog Hullabaloo. So, Heather, we have a situation now in our, I guess, our politics, our news, that is very much consistent with where we were a week ago, both in terms of the trajectory of COVID-19, the trajectory of the Republican Party, the trajectory of the tantrum-er-in-chief, and on some level, the trajectory that was established within the Democratic caucus in the House, and I think also with Joe Biden's nascent presidency. You know, last week we said it really appears that he has wrapped this up, and it now appears that he has really, really wrapped it up, Joe Biden. The numbers continue to go up, and he's actually now, his win is now we're moving into sort of like historical territory in terms of the size of the popular vote, in terms of the percentage in which he won, particularly as a challenger, and the electoral votes that he won as a challenger. So Joe Biden's victory is not just no longer in doubt, but it is now becoming a significant historical win. We should also maybe touch upon why it didn't help down ballot, because Democrats are going to have some real problems there. We obviously are going to see a runoff with two races in Georgia. We'll put that aside for the moment. Donald Trump is clinging on to the idea that he won the race. Whether he believes that or not is most irrelevant. The Republicans are clinging on to Donald Trump, whether they believe him or not, that's irrelevant. And why don't we start? And we should say the trajectory of COVID, the number of hospitalizations in this country is somewhere around between 60 and 70,000 as we speak. And at least 10,000 of those hospitalizations, the number of people hospitalized at any given time has gone up by 10,000 in really the past week and a half. So it is we are hitting escape velocity, as it were, with COVID. But it's a good place to talk about all of these things by starting with the first person who's been named to the would-be Biden administration, and that is Ron Klain, who has been named chief of staff. Ron Klain was chief of staff for Al Gore at one point. He has been an aide to Joe Biden off and on for 30 years, having started in his late 20s, I think, in the Judiciary Committee. Working for Biden when he was chairing that. He served as a clerk for Justice Byron White. He worked on the recount campaign, if you will, for Al Gore in the 2000 election. He was the Ebola czar for the Obama administration. I'm actually holding in my hand, which is why we want to start with him, holding in my hand a piece he wrote on October 15th, 2018 in Vox. And it is an extended piece. And it is a piece about his concern about a pandemic killing tens of millions of people being a real possibility. And he writes, "We are not prepared for it." That was the title. And boy, oh boy, did he sadly nail that one. We don't have, I think, as virulent of a pandemic as he thought was possible. At least now we don't. But it is certainly a dangerous one, and it is certainly as contagious as he anticipated. So I think, you know, in terms of a pick, in terms of dealing with what we're facing as far as a crisis in this country, Ron Klain, pretty good.
Very good. I'm actually kind of a fan of Ron Klain, and even though what you described there is sort of the Zelig of, you know, Democratic politics for 30 years, it seems like he's been everywhere. I think he's a pretty good guy. I have never seen, even throughout the periods where we've been, you know, people like you and I have been in opposition to Democratic establishment type things during Obama or even going back further than that, various campaigns and whatever. Klain has never been one of those people where I was just watching and going, get out of here. You know, you're
right.
Being a hack. He'd never had that kind of thing. Now, I could be, you know, I don't know him personally, but, you know, I've been watching, he's been around on TV a lot in the last few years, you know, during the Trump era here. And he's always been pretty right on. I mean, I never saw any of that kind of reflexive, well, everybody keep your powder dry kind of thing. You know, he seemed to be pretty clear-eyed. And obviously his resume is, you know, incredible. And obviously the right person for this moment between the pandemic experience and all the, you know, executive experience and ability to sort of, you know, get hit the ground running, which clearly is going to be required because they're not helping. And even if they did, I mean, let's face it, if Biden was in there with the Trump people, they'd be doing nothing but obstructing them and doing whatever anyway. So I have no, you know, sort of this idea that the transition is being, you know, somehow sabotaged because of Trump. I mean, it's wrong. It's terrible. It shouldn't be happening. But I also don't think it's going to be hugely impactful in terms of how the Biden administration takes office. And Klain is somebody who, you know, obviously will know how to work every lever and work, you know, understands how government is supposed to work and may be able to diagnose the situations where it's clear that the Trump administration has either laid landmines purposefully or just out of complete incompetence has allowed the executive branch to atrophy in some way so that it's not really functional anyway. So, you know, I feel like he's a good choice, and the fact that they came out with him first, that's meaningful to me because it kind of signals that, you know, this isn't a person who's hostile to progressives.
Yes.
I've never gotten that feeling.
I agree totally
and he's not
with that.
Some, you know, and so that it's like saying, look, we're going for somebody here who is, you know, has the right ideas and is also someone who is competent and experienced and will be able to guide us through this very tumultuous period, which clearly it's going to be, as you point out, COVID is just raging. And we are, you know, it's not going to be better in January when
no.
Biden takes over. It's going to probably be worse. And I don't know where the country's going to be in that situation. And they're just, the government at the moment is just completely
abdicated.
It's AWOL. It's
just totally
not there. I mean,
AWOL.
They're just not even trying. So, you know.
Well, let me second everything you said about Klain. It's funny that you said he's not hostile to the left because that's literally when I, you know, as soon as something like this happens, I'm sure you get this too. You know, all your friends who are sort of politics adjacent, you know, text you to get your take on these things. And
right.
I literally had two sentences that I would copy and paste to every one of those people who texted me, which is super competent dealing with pandemic, not hostile to the left. And you know, I mean, I wish we could say, wow, Joe Biden picked a really progressive chief of staff. But I mean, that was never going to happen.
Right.
That ship sailed, you know, in March, frankly. But Ron Klain, he is, you know, I remember when Barack Obama picked Rahm Emanuel, and I remember being somewhere between distraught and like, well, maybe, you know, like trying to work out like different scenarios where this could be helpful. Maybe it's good to have a guy like this on, you know, the inside pissing out. And instead, I realized like I wasn't on the inside. I was going to be one of the people he was going to be pissing on, essentially. I mean, in terms of, you know, what politics I shared. Ron Klain, I don't think is like that. I think both in terms of like he's not dispositionally like that. But I think that he is a guy who is at the very least open and, you know, sympathetic to the more progressive side of the party. I don't think he is would describe himself that way or situates himself there, but he's certainly not, like you say, one of these one of these hacks. And the other thing that's encouraging, and you know, we had mentioned this before we started to record today, Barack Obama's a book has come out. I have not read any of the excerpts. I know you've looked at a little bit of it, and it exhibits a healthy dose of skepticism about Republicans and about the nature of our or the potential for unity in this country right now. Ron Klain also strikes me as a guy who both worked on the in the Obama administration in the response to the financial crisis. And he strikes me as a guy who has learned some lessons and does no longer, and I don't know if he ever did, but he certainly doesn't now have any illusions as to who the Republican Party is and what can be achieved by them or with them. And I think that is a very healthy and encouraging starting point, right? I mean, it took like 6.5 years for the Obama administration to realize that. And that by that point, they couldn't do anything. I think, you know, a day one, in fact, a day minus, you know, whatever it is, 50 perspective on Republicans that way is extremely helpful. And, he strikes me as a very competent guy, or at least knowledgeable when it comes to a pandemic. And that has to be job one. I mean, both from a technical standpoint and also a political one, right? I mean, you want Joe Biden to come in there and by February, 10, let's say, the second week of February, you want them to be rolling out a plan, which people are going to see a material difference, at least in those states that are going to be hurting. And frankly, I am terrified as to what this country is going to look like in January, because people should understand what we're experiencing now, where hospitals seem to be on the brink in many states across the country of being incapable of intake. You know, we're getting to that zone where people have to start to make decisions about ICUs soon, right? Where some people are just going to be taken out of the ICUs and their, the chances of survival, a severe case of COVID goes down significantly because there's just not enough people to, I mean, you can make beds, but you can't make nurses and you can't make doctors overnight. And what we're seeing now is a function of infections that happened 4 or 5 weeks ago. And I'm not seeing a dramatic change in the sensibility, particularly in these hotspots, of people's perspective towards COVID that would suggest that we're going to see a marked, a flattening of this curve, as it were. I mean, the curve, it's not even a curve right now. It is like a trajectory straight up. I mean, we're at a, if you look at the chart, it looks like a rocket. And 4 weeks from now, it's going to be exponentially worse. Then you add in the cold weather, which I think increases its transmittability because the air gets drier and people also go inside. And the behavior that's being exhibited by a lot of parts of this country in terms of like no mask and no social distancing means that flu rates of people catching the flu could be as if it was a normal year. And the problem is that's going to push a lot of people out of those beds. And so we could be looking at something incredibly distressing. And, you know, as a political matter, I agree with you. The idea that the Trump administration will not give the Biden administration the keys, that's going to work in Biden's favor, I think, in some respects, in terms of getting people on board with his plans and giving him more time, than people presume he has, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't envy anybody coming into this job at this point. Everything you said about the pandemic is absolutely true. And the government is completely AWOL. I mean, they're doing nothing at this point. And I see there's no evidence or no realistic hope that they're going to. I mean, they didn't before. They have no incentive. Their only incentive in the White House is political, which was to get Trump reelected. And of course, they botched that. And now they're simply not going to do anything. And to the extent they have any belief in any kind of strategy for COVID, it's herd immunity, which is a grotesque mass death event is what they're basically going for. So, and that's even if they even think about it. I mean, clearly Trump is no longer, you know, working as a president, not that he ever did, but I don't think anybody around him is either. So that's that. I mean, that's the situation that we're dealing with. And, you know, all you have to do is look at the Republicans in the Congress to see that they're right there with him. I mean, I'm not seeing anybody forget coming forward and saying, oh, Trump should concede and we need to move forward with the PDB and all the stuff that people are talking about, that maybe some Republicans might sort of start to think about saying something about any of that. They're saying nothing about COVID either. Hmm. You know, if they wanted to, I mean, there's nothing stopping them from that, from coming out and talking about it, telling people to wear a mask. You're starting to see it in some of the states, right? I mean, I noticed that Mike DeWine in Ohio came out, gave a speech to his constituents, I think it was on Wednesday night, saying, look, we are in trouble here. Everybody has got to do it. You know, I mean, they're starting to get the panic at the state level. But I see nothing among these Republicans that they even are giving it a passing thought, despite the fact that though even in the White House, they've had, you know, how they had that White House election night party, and I think six people have gone down with COVID from that. So, you know, they're still spreading. And by the way, Trump's talking about doing rallies. And, you know, not so much for, I don't think, to change anything. I mean, maybe he thinks in his mind it might help. But really, he's setting himself up for his, you know, his post-presidency, and rallies, you know, are an intrinsic part of his identity at this point. So more super spreading. I could absolutely see him doing that without giving it a second thought. So, I mean, this is, you know, one of the things, I mean, you mentioned the, you know, in the Obama book, the quote that sticks out at me that has come, I saw it in two different reviews that I read, and I haven't read it either, obviously. It's not out yet, and I don't have access to these things prior to publication. But the quote that sticks out to me is that he says the only difference between Trump's style of politics and theirs, meaning the GOP, is Trump's lack of inhibition. So he gets it. He understands that Trump is not the problem. And that, you know, it is the Republican Party is the problem and has been for a long time. And it seems to me he kind of, and I'll be interested to read the book, I plan to, is that, you know, he seems to have recognized somewhere along the line that part of the problem, which you and I have talked about for years, is the Democrats' unwillingness to admit that and to understand what they're dealing with and to deal with these, with politics on this level. And I, you know, getting back to Ron Klain, I am hopeful that he is one of those people who understands that, because, and I've seen him on TV a lot, you know, maybe he's playing a role, I don't know. But it does seem to me that something, you know, hopefully, at least among some Democrats, perhaps not the leadership in Congress, but others, and maybe not even the president-elect, Joe Biden, but among people who are working in politics, that they're getting it. And if Obama says this overtly in his book, and every one of them will read it, of course, because, you know, he's the Democratic idol, that he has made that realization, that he has come to that conclusion, that he understands what we're dealing with, maybe there's a chance that Democrats will figure out a way to get around this in order to fix the crisis that they're going to be dealing with immediately, which isn't only COVID in terms of, you know, dealing with the disease itself, but the economic fallout, which is going to be massive. I mean, imagine what happens now, Sam. I mean, if this thing hurtles completely out of control over the next 3 months, which it sure looks like it's going to, I don't know what could stop it. I mean, there is nothing to stop it. What kind of an economic nightmare are they going to be met with? So, I mean, this is huge, and they have to understand that particularly if McConnell gets the Senate, but also the destruction of the executive branch and the burrowing in. I mean, I wrote about this, you know, they're burrowing all these absolute, you know, right-wing.
I'm convinced that's what this firing of the Pentagon thing is. It's just like, how many different things can we screw up that they're going to have to repair so that they don't have the ability to deploy resources to actually doing the job of the presidency, but rather, you know, like, I mean, it's almost like we're going to go in and we're going to take a sledgehammer to the bathroom. We're going to take a sledgehammer to the kitchen. You know, we're going to screw up all this stuff. So when they move into the house, they're not going to be able to, you know, pick out some new furniture for the living room. This, they're going to have to go and work on the infrastructure of the entire thing. But I want, yeah, and I want to get to that, but I want to stay in this realm of, like, you know, is there a new, there seems to me there's two things that the Democrats have to do that are essential at this point, and that the party has not been able to really do in a decade or two. And one is what you say is have an awareness of who the Republicans are and to act accordingly. You know, it's one thing to get up there and say, like, I want unity. But if you actually believe that's attainable, if you actually believe that you have a partner across the aisle in terms of because, I mean, look, and we're going to see this and it's going to drive me crazy. In fact, you know, occasionally I see on Twitter and it's like, I gotta constrain every fiber in my body not to like, you know, just lunge. But this notion of we all want the same thing, it's just we have a disagreement about how to go to it, how to get to it. If people to hold the idea in their heads that Republicans and Democrats, And I consider myself, you know, left of the certainly of the center of the Democratic Party. And I think, like, within the spectrum, you know, that spectrum on the left, I think you could arguably say that, you know, we want the same thing. We just have a different notion of what's going to get us there for the most part. I'm not sure how comfortable I am with that, but I am incredibly uncomfortable. In fact, it's just out and out wrong. Republicans do not have the same end goals as Democrats, right? Like, you cannot look at what they've done over this past week and a half and in any way convince yourself that they have the same, you know, interests at the end. They don't care about those things. They simply do not care. We would have a stimulus by now. We would have a some type of transition so that Joe Biden could be president. They don't care. They don't care. They don't have that goal where, you know, everybody wants to do the same thing and everybody wants, you know, people to do that. That doesn't exist. And the understanding of that by our Democratic leaders is hugely important, to understand that they do not have the same incentive structure that the Democrats have. The other thing is that, and this is what's coming out in that fight, I want to say it's between AOC, you know, wing of the party, and Nancy Pelosi. But, you know, Doug Jones from Alabama, former Senator Doug Jones, weighed in and frankly weighed in on the side of these essentially younger, newer Democrats, which is, and he put it very well. He said in this Washington Post piece, he said that he was interviewed for, he said, Democrats invest in candidates, and they are not investing in districts. In other words, they are not organizing people on the ground. They are not engaging in best practices. They come out, they invest in candidates that they think have the special, you know, like, you know, demographic slash, not even the demographic, like just sort of like the profile that's going to, appeal to Republicans or independents and swing voters, instead of investing long term on the ground, building organization, essentially, so that these things can be mobilized. I mean, we saw Arizona and Georgia are the two states that came through, and Pennsylvania, for Joe Biden. And that was all a function of on the ground organizing that was taking place there. And in places where you had an anemic Democratic Party and a useless one, and there wasn't outside expenditures of unions, or of Hispanic groups like there was in Arizona, or community organizers like there was in Georgia, or Facebook groups, frankly, like you saw in Pennsylvania, the Democrats lost. And so there is a fundamental flaw in the practices of Democrats, on top of which I think there's some messaging issues, but there's no messaging that is going to be successful, I think, it seems to me, when you don't have that infrastructure, unless you're running specifically, unless you're Joe Biden running against Donald Trump, because everybody else down ticket got wiped out. And
well, I mean, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to, you know, punctuate what you just said about the on the ground organizing in those three states. This has been extremely important. It was done outside the party in all three cases. And it wasn't just Facebook groups in Pennsylvania. Part of what, you know, one of the big success stories in Pennsylvania for Biden was the suburban vote outside of Philadelphia, which was huge for him. And that was done by these groups that sort of formed themselves.
Right, Indivisible.
After the 2016 election. Yeah, I mean, all those
left.
And part of what they have found, and I mean, this is truly a profound insight, because this election got huge turnout, gigantic turnout on both sides. I mean, unbelievable turnout on both sides, largely because Donald Trump was at the top of the ticket. I don't have any illusions about whether it was about ideas or, you know, any
right.
kind of agenda. It was just about that. And so all this turnout came out, but in the places where Democrats actually did better, they had this kind of personal interaction, grassroots organizing that was going on. In Arizona, for instance, the Hispanic groups that were organized down there, and they've been doing it for a decade. It didn't just spring up overnight. I mean,
right.
this has been a long,
a lot of this came out of
fog.
Arpaio, Joseph Arpaio.
Right, Arpaio, right. That whole thing. I mean, this has been coming for a while there in Arizona. We saw it in Georgia. Stacey Abrams, you know, she's had a national profile for a while, but she's been working on this for years. And what this says is that it, you know, whether you believe in turnout or persuasion or whatever, you know, that we had the turnout this time. It didn't work on the down ballot races so much, which indicates that you need to have something more, right? I mean, turnout isn't going to do it. There was a piece written this week by Zaid Jilani, who's a writer at The Intercept and is a, you know, I mean, he's a very respected, I would say, you know, left part of the party sort of voice, who noted all this about turnout. And one of the things that you find is that in those places in Georgia, I mean, they had people working in the grassroots in the way we used to think about that. It wasn't just getting all their phone numbers. It was people kind of creating relationships and getting people to sort of see the democratic, you know, wherever you fall on that democratic spectrum, right? I mean, you and I are on the further left and there are more people in the center. But still, as you say, you know, we're in, I guess, in terms of values, we're on that side of the coalition for a reason. And, you know, they create these relationships in these places. And are able to actually persuade people because of that. Now, the Democratic Party has never valued that. I mean, you and I have been doing this for a long time. We're going all the way back to the early 2000s when you had Howard Dean in 2004.
Right.
The 50-state, you know,
yep.
50-state project or whatever it was as the DNC. He left the DNC and they dropped it. And, you know, you have to look at Obama for that because
yep.
that changing of the guard is what changed it. And, you know, you have to have that kind of, and it's not campaign offices. That's not what we're talking about. It's getting people to be civically involved and understand what just the basic idea of what politics are. And using, you know, getting involved on the local level, doing things that sort of create these relationships. And that's what has worked in terms of turning some of these places in the suburban and exurban areas in red states like Georgia and Arizona. That's what has worked, is having these people just doing that. And there's so much money sloshing around, Sam. It makes me sick that we can't find a way to fund some of this. So people can do this and that they've got a little bit of support to do it. I mean,
yep.
you shouldn't have to spend, you know, to buy your own pencils, you know, to do this kind of thing. I mean, there's a lot of money in this, and people are just rolling in it, and there needs to be some sort of refocusing on that. And I'm not sure, honest to tell you, I'm not sure I want the party to do this. I'm not sure, you know, any kind of top-down thing. What you want is just resources going toward these places where they can actually do the work themselves, I think.
Well, you know, in many respects, it is filling the void that unions filled at one time.
Right.
And you know, people don't talk about this, but I wonder if what we saw, what we're seeing, you know, like what we saw in Georgia. Like, I wonder, had Acorn not been dismantled, and if we aren't seeing sort of like, you know, now we're 10 years out from Acorn, basically, you know, if we aren't seeing sort of like the seeds that were spread when Acorn was smashed, I don't want to get too metaphorical here about the acorns, but if we're not seeing like some of the, you know, some of the small trees sprouting up, you know, as those organizations, you know, sort of reform in a non-national level. But I am with you insofar as it would be nice if we had resources that were disseminated to these organizations while they were still outside of the party apparatus. Because the fact is that, and I think that, you know, AOC was alluding to this, and others have too, frankly, you have a Democratic Party where, and look, it's like any other organization, it seems to me, in many respects, which is at one point, things get too cozy, people get too narrow in their perspective when they are faced with different practices in terms of, you know, completing their job. They defer to the one where they're going to be putting a dollar in their friend's pocket, or they're going to be putting a dollar in their own pocket, just a different set of pants, if you will, right? Like, I'm a consultant, I'm brought on to run this campaign or to advise this campaign. So my advice to you is you need to put on more television commercials. Why? Because I get my 10 or 15% cut of everything we buy on media. Why is that? It's just the way it's always been. Now we got to go to an outside advertising firm or a firm that will make commercials. Oh, that's great. What a coincidence. I happen to be a partner at one of those. So we'll send money back to my firm. I mean, this is the way it works. It works like this in a lot of different enterprises. The only difference is that those enterprises are not receiving donations from millions of people who are expecting best practices to be used, not ones that are most profitable for the individuals who are using them. And I think, you know, community-based groups are less inclined to have those kind of dynamics, frankly.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, and you even find it in, I mean, I remember reading, I can't remember who, it's somebody who works in this sort of, you know, grassroots organizing realm across that even groups like Indivisible, which sprang up after 2016, once they started getting sort of a national organizing function, things started to go south on that level. I mean, some of the individual groups in places like Pennsylvania continued to work on their own. But once you get into this, you know, this sort of top-down thing, things tend to fall, you know, they end up kind of becoming bureaucratized in a way that sort of takes away the energy that was originally there for these groups. And, you know, we have this tremendous organizing capacity around digital. And one of the things that I thought AOC was super spot on about was her, you know, scathing critique of the way that the Democratic, you know, these Democratic candidates and the party as a whole just refuses to deal with digital in any kind of a sophisticated way. Yeah. And in that sense, the Republicans are way ahead of us, right? I mean, they use it for propaganda and disinformation, but nonetheless, they do use it, and they use it much more effectively. And the idea that they didn't devote more energy into that is just, that was an astonishing thing to me, because I actually didn't know it. And, you know, that's, again, makes you wonder about, you know, when you look at the congressional level and you look at the way that they've been dealing with these big behemoths and, you know, the monopolies that are going on. I mean, you and I talked about this a couple of weeks ago, that, you know, there seems to be a problem with the Democrats and dealing with these big digital companies. They do not seem to be able to do that. And it's a twofold thing. You got to be able to use it properly, and you also have to police it properly. And we're not, you know, I don't know where we're going to go in a Biden administration. It's probably not top of their priority list, but it should be, because the influence of these are huge. And you know, that's, again, another place where the Democrats are kind of atrophied and stuck in the same way that you describe the consultants who come in and say we've got to put more TV ads on. You know, there's a lack of creativity, a lack of sort of acceptance of the modern, you know, world that we're living in, the modern political world, and I think it's hurt them a lot. I mean, even aside from the messaging, it's again, it's a lack of sort of, you know, focus on what works and sort of clinging to the ideas that, well, we'll just get swept in on this or that, hoping that, you know, there's somebody they can either hate or love. I mean, that's really what it comes down to, is that, you know, have we got an inspiring Obama figure at the top, or have we got, you know, a loathsome creature like Trump on the other side, and we'll just roll with that wave going back and forth. And that just, that is not, you know, that's why we end up in situations like with like Donald Trump. I mean, if you're putting everything on that sort of level where it's all about who's got the charisma or who can we hate and nothing going down, I mean, people don't even know what politics are anymore. And that's certainly happened on the right. And I think it's happened on the left a little bit, too. I mean, Obama seemed to me to be kind of, you know, the other side of the coin of Donald Trump in some ways. You know, there was so much emphasis put on him personally and how,
yeah.
I mean, luckily for us, he was a decent human being and an intelligent guy who, you know, actually learned from mistakes and, you know, whatever. I'm not trying to put him down too hard, but really, that was a charisma campaign. So
and,
was the Trump campaign.
And
we got to stop that.
Well, and here's the problem, is that in both those instances, whether we are promoting our own charismatic figure or attacking the Republicans, you know, charismatic figure, as it were, the problem is down ballot, we do not have the organization to make up for the fact that there is nothing they can run on. There is no programmatic thing or theme for them to run on. And that's why I'm convinced 2018, you had a lot of people came out to vote against Donald Trump but he wasn't on the ticket. So they reached for the closest Republican they could vote against. But when you get to 2020 and Joe Biden is saying, you know, we need a strong Republican Party. And when you have Nancy Pelosi saying we need a strong Republican Party, and when you have them putting John Kasich on at the RNC and a half dozen other Republicans, and you're sending the message that there's Donald Trump and then there's the Republicans, and if there's no connection between those things, like if you're not problematic, if you still identify as a Republican. And I feel bad. I know it's not nice to paint everybody with a broad brush, but I'm sorry. In the context of the politics, well, first off, I think it's true. But yeah, in the context of the politics, even if it wasn't, I'm okay with painting that broad a brush. I don't know who the Republican is that I'm supposed to think is reasonable and appreciate and want to exist. But even if I did, I'm sorry. I mean, look, for instance, this week, even, and that's why the Democrats really got, in many respects, destroyed down ballot. When you have the other party in power, Democrats should have done better, just generically speaking, never mind that the other person was Donald Trump. But this week, I watched Chris Coons, who is very close with Joe Biden, who was one of his surrogates, in fact, maybe the surrogate in the Senate. He goes on television and they're talking to him about, like, and he's doing an okay job in terms of just, you know, the sheer partisanship of, you know, how can these Republicans be doing this? They need to, you know, Donald Trump needs to step aside and, you know, Joe Biden needs to get started. And he was asked by the CNN host, like, what are Republicans saying to you in private? And then he goes, well, actually, they're wishing Joe Biden congratulations, and they're saying that they wish that Donald Trump wouldn't do this. And I'm thinking to myself, like, are you serious? Why did you just spend all this time talking about Republicans and what they're doing this and that when you just turn around and go, like, but deep down, they're good people, and they don't want to do this. They're just forced into doing it, you know. If this is private conversations, then keep it private. Don't let them go out and do all this political machinations in public, which are supposed to drive turnout in the key runoff races of Georgia, which could be the most important Senate races of our lifetime, frankly, on some level. We'll see. But don't let them go out and score those political points and then pay no political price. Don't turn around and say, oh, and now let me diffuse all of any type of real anger against them. So they're just going to have the benefit of communicating to their own people and getting them riled up. But when I'm communicating to my people, I'm going to say, hey, you know what? Tamp it down. They're actually good guys. I mean, where is there any sense of politics here? Is there any sense that this is like, this is real? This is not about you, you know, feeling warm. If these people want to make it public, you make them make it public. You don't do their job for them. You don't say like, hey, I know this is going to cost you a lot to make this political machination, but don't worry. I'm going to mitigate that cost for you. I mean, that's what he's doing. It is malpractice. Like, I don't even know, like, this isn't negligent, manslaughter. I mean, this is like, we're close to homicide here in terms of like level of malignance to do something like that. It's so, tone deaf. So I don't even know how to express it. What a failure of politics.
Well, it's a total failure, and it has, you know, like the media does this, right? They say, well, you know, Republicans are telling us.
Jake Tapper did that too.
I get that. That's part of their, you know, but that's part of their job, right? I mean, they offer anonymity. We can have a whole conversation about whether they should or whether they do it appropriately. No, Chris Coons does not have that. He does not have that. He can either name names, come out and say, you know, look, John Thune, you know, told me in the cloakroom that he is, you know, to go to Joe Biden and tell him he's looking forward to working. That's what John Thune told me.
Right.
He can use that name and he can do it. He doesn't have any agreement about talking on background or whatever. Or, as you put it, he can shut up and let John Thune go out there and, you know, say all this crazy stuff on behalf of Donald Trump and let him do that. And let him suffer or not, whatever happens. But why he should bail his buddy
exactly
out on this is ridiculous. And it only hurts our side. I hadn't even thought about until you just said it, the effect that has on our side.
And it gives license.
Say, look, these guys aren't that really that bad. Come on, don't worry. It'll be fine.
It gives license to the reporters to do it. It gives license to the report. I mean, like, you can't blame the reporters for doing this when a Democratic senator is going like, hey, I'm up here to excoriate the Republicans, but also to tell you that they're deep down, they're actually pretty good. So don't get too worked up. I mean, the answer to the question is, what are they saying to you in private is nothing.
Yeah.
What you see is what you get, as far as I can tell. And that's it.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, and it's not like the other side gives them the benefit of the doubt like that.
Oh, my gosh, no.
When they're out there talking to their people, they talk about Chris Coons, the centrist of all centrists, like he's Fidel Castro. I mean, they don't have any problem basically just completely trashing every Democrat. I mean, look what they're doing with Chuck Schumer. You know, you and I both, you know, neither of us have any great warm feelings toward Chuck Schumer. But he came out and said, and next we're going to take over Georgia or whatever. And there you can use that in ads all over Georgia like he was talking, like he was Sherman coming in to burn Atlanta, right? I mean, they don't play that way. They do not protect, you know, Democrats from themselves. They never do that. If they find an opening, they use it. And you know, this is the kind of ruthless politics that they're playing that, you know, for whatever reason, it just seems like, you know, I mean, this has been going on for year after year. And I mean, I'm not saying that politics has to be scorched earth and that, you know, I hate the Republicans so much that I just want them all to be destroyed, blah, blah, blah. This is not a matter of choice. This isn't something, you know, I mean, I think, you know, I'm a fairly, you know, level-headed human being here. But what I've observed, and it's not just Trump, again, this goes all the way back, we're dealing with a Republican Party that has gone extreme, you know, very, very radical. And they've gone radical over a long period of time, and the Democrats have let them do it.
Yep.
And so we don't have a tool to stop this unless we have those people willing to do it. And unfortunately, we end up every single time having to fight amongst ourselves first. You know, we've got to have some big knockdown, drag-out fight between the left and the center and the establishment and the outsiders and blah, 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 however you want to do it, in order to get them to actually do the things they need to do in order to even have a remote chance of passing an agenda. And this is just, you know, or even stopping the bleeding in this case. I mean, we are in huge crisis. And we just can't get them to move off that dime. And you know, part of it, you and I have talked about the gerontocracy aspect of this, and it is true that some of that is just, you know, and I know this myself. I mean, I find myself sort of sounding like an old person these days in a way that I would never have imagined I would when I was younger, you know, just sort of, or just,
same.
And it happens to people when you get older. You just get more, you know, sort of stuck in your way of thinking, or you find that you've been outflanked, I think, by younger people who are thinking in a bold new way. I'm sure I was that way with older people when I was young. And I get it. I understand. And there's some place for older wisdom and, you know, experience and all that. I mean, that's part of it, the whole thing, too. But I don't know that this period of time, it is useful to have only these really old people.
Oh, without a doubt. I think you're right. And I think part of it is also just sort of like, not just that they're like physically old, it's just like from where they from when they learned their political lessons was a very different era. And here's the one thing, and you know, because we'll wrap up here in a second, but the interesting thing is this, and I don't know, maybe this question's not really, you know, the answer to this question is not necessarily relevant. I'm not sure. But what you and I are talking about, and what AOC, and this is what I, you know, like honestly, like I never cared more about Doug Jones than that one quote, because what we're talking about is partisanship. What we're talking about is best practices. What we're talking about is being on a whatever you want to call it, a battlefield, a playing field. Being on in a theater where you understand what is going on and you attempt to win, right? Now, my inclination is to see that as distinct from ideology. And however, you know, there's that age-old question, and maybe, again, it's the answer is not relevant, is like, do they avoid or are they incapable of exercising best practices? Because from an ideological perspective, they don't see the urgency of the problems here, that the stakes are just lower because their perspective on the world is different. And therefore, they don't see, they're just simply not as worried about best practices. Like, I mean, you know, the only thing I could tell you is like in the context of my job. Like at one point, you know, this podcast, not this one per se, but you know, my other podcast, it's good enough and it's doing well enough that I'm not going to like optimize my videos, you know, in the way that I may have, you know, a couple of years ago. Cause I'm like, yeah, whatever. It's a marginal difference and I don't need to fight for every ground in some level. And I can't help but think that they're not ideologically driven to drag their feet, but they don't feel, but their ideology makes it possible for them to not see the urgency, which then allows them to drag their feet.
Yeah. Well, I think you're right. And I do, you know, obviously, again, there's a difference between being, you know, closer to the end of your life than to the beginning of your life. The urgency is a different kind of urgency.
True.
I understand that. But that is not where we are as a country, as a political party, as a planet. I mean, there is urgency. I mean, and, you know, young or old, you should be able to see that and understand that the stakes have never been higher. This isn't the post-war. I mean, you know, we've always had crises. You know, there was the Cold War, nuclear threat, you know, a lot of things that have happened. But we are entering this new era here with this, you know, if nothing else, the threat of climate change,
right,
which is existential to human life. And the idea, and yet, and it's going to require smart people, not Donald Trump people, and not craven, loathsome monsters like Mitch McConnell. Those people have got to be defeated.
Yep.
They just have to be, because we have no choice here. So that urgency on the part of young people like AOC, I totally get it. And I also think that your point about partisanship here is hugely important. That, you know, ideology aside, and we may have differences amongst all of us, it's a big coalition with a lot of different people and from different places, different ages, different, you know, ethnic and racial makeup, et cetera. And we all have our priorities, but this is something we should all be on exactly the same page about. And the partisanship of that, it couldn't be more stark. The Republicans don't care if the planet burns up. They don't care. And if we haven't seen that illustrated, their nihilistic worldview illustrated with the way they've reacted to COVID, I don't know what it would take. So let's, you know, they have to be taken out of the equation. And that means either ignoring them, gaining enough power to put them, you know, make them, you know, some kind of peanut gallery yammering in the, you know, in the corner. But the last thing we need is a strong Republican Party. We need a weak, weak, weak Republican Party, the weakest we can get.
Indeed.
Because otherwise they're going to stand in the way of saving the planet. I mean, it's obvious.
Heather Parton, Digby, thank you so much for your time today. Always a pleasure.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Sam.
Executive actions will be key to the success of the first term in the Biden presidency. Here to discuss what the Democratic president needs to do, starting on day one, David Dayen, editor of the American Prospect. So, David, here we are. We are looking at a Biden presidency, but you know, this is still up in the air. We don't know how Georgia is going to work out. It's conceivable that Joe Biden will have a Democratic Congress, House and Senate. But even if everything goes well in Georgia, it's going to be the slimmest of margins in the Senate. We have Joe Manchin saying that he wouldn't vote for the destruction of the filibuster. So Biden's legislative agenda, at least now, even in the best case scenario, doesn't look terribly promising, which makes the edition of the American Prospect that you oversaw a year ago now on the ability of the next president to use its executive authority with pre-existing laws to do all sorts of things that are on the wish list of a lot of progressives. Let's talk about that. And congratulations to you, because as far as I know, that's the most comprehensive compilation of things that can be done. And it's almost impossible for me to imagine that there aren't people in the Biden transition team who aren't looking at that document or that entire edition of the American Prospect right now.
Well, I certainly hope so. You know, we really looked at this because if you remember back to the fall of 2019, that level of sort of liberal despair that even if we beat Trump and win back the White House, that the agenda would be frustrated by Mitch McConnell, even if they took back the Senate, that it would be frustrated. That was palpable at that time.
Yep.
In the summer and fall of 2009. And you know, it all you have to do is look at your pocket constitution and find out that the main function of a president is to take care that the laws are faithfully executed. And it turns out that over the 240-odd years that Congress has been in session, they have managed to write a good number of laws. And a lot of those laws haven't really been used to their, let's say, fullest potential. And a president with the will and creativity and aggressiveness and an administration that you know, an executive branch that backs him up, can really get a lot done.
Maybe we should also talk about, you know, at one point, maybe we'll circle back around to the question of who Joe Biden has appointed or is looking at that may provide that sort of creativity and energy and will around Joe Biden. I still contend that Joe Biden is my is a cipher, which is the my second favorite type of politician who that I would vote for. The first being, of course, someone who agrees with my ideas. The second, of course, being the one who you could perhaps get to adopt your ideas. But let's talk about, like, let's, but before we get to that, as to whether there is, you know, what your prognostications are in terms of the personnel he surrounds himself with, let's talk about some of the main issue silos, if you will, that the president has a substantial body of law that they could enact that has not been enacted to achieve progressive aims. Where would you start in terms of the biggest opportunities?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it really, I guess, depends on what you think are the biggest challenges facing the country. If you think that financialization and the dominance of large banks on Wall Street is really the biggest problem that we have, then sure, there's a plenty that you can do through Dodd-Frank and other laws to cut those big banks down to size. If you think that corporate power more generally is a huge problem that has, you know, different manifestations on wages and on innovation and on democracy itself, then you might want to beef up the antitrust and anti-monopoly enforcement. And certainly a president has the ability to do that. If you think that higher education and how we finance it has become this lead weight that you know is on the necks of an entire generation of students, then maybe canceling student debt would be something that you think is like the most critical thing to do right now to jumpstart the economy. And actually, a president can do that unilaterally on his own authority. If you think that our healthcare system is what is you know, holding back this country, then there are options for example, radically lowering the cost of prescription drugs through seizing patents that for drugs that are being, you know, administered at very high prices. So it's really, I mean, and I could go on, right? So it's really a robust agenda. I mean, that's what we call it, the day one agenda. It's not one area. It's really across sort of every issue set of things that you can do to really make progress for people.
And so, all right. Well, so and what would inhibit the president from exercising his authority in this instance? I mean, is it just simply will? Creativity? Like, why can't could there be theoretically a half a dozen executive orders or directives that on day one, he says, okay, boom, DOJ, I want you guys to actually start to interpret, antitrust in, use a different perception of antitrust. For instance,
right.
I mean, just I think it was today or yesterday, the EU filed, I think, two different types of antitrust charges against Amazon that had nothing to do with their, with what consumers were paying, but rather about how anti-competitive they were. I know this is something obviously you've talked quite about, you've written about. But could Joe Biden do that? Does he even need to write anything? Can he just simply say to his attorney general, hey, philosophically, I want antitrust to go back to pre-Bork regime?
Yeah, I mean, I think specifically he would instruct the attorney general to change the merger guidelines. There are guidelines by which mergers are conducted, and you can alter those to better reflect the spirit of the Sherman Act, in my view, monopolization has multiple harms, and anytime those harms are presented, that presents a problem for mergers, and it should present a problem for these companies. You know, you ask the question of, is there anything stopping them or what is stopping them? I mean, it could be just sort of the tyranny of tradition. What we saw in the last Democratic administration is Barack Obama really, really, really wanted to come up with bipartisan compromises and engage Republicans on a whole host of issues. And it took him about 6 years to figure out that that wasn't working. And then he started talking about how I have a pen and I have a phone, and that's what I'll do to make progress for the American people. And that's when, only at that point, did he put together something like the DACA program to protect Dreamers and use the discretion in terms of deportation and immigration authority, something that the Trump administration tried to overturn, were rebuffed at the Supreme Court, and that Joe Biden has said on day one he would restore the DACA program to where it was before the Trump administration. So, you know, on that alone, we went from waiting 6 years to waiting 24 hours, right?
Right.
So we made progress there with respect to immigration. There's no reason why a Biden administration can't make that same kind of progress across a whole range of issues.
And how durable are these changes? Because if it is a question of discretion, essentially, right? I mean, we have all these tools available to us, and the president decides to use a couple or doesn't, and that's it. Like, how durable are these things?
Yeah, it depends on what you're talking about, right? I mean, I think there are certain things that when you reinterpret the law, it's just going to stay reinterpreted. Like, for example, if you cancel a large swath of student debt, I highly doubt that any president afterwards is going to say, I uncancel hereby that student debt and you owe me $50,000.
Right. I see what you're saying.
I just don't see that happening. Same with, I think there are other things where it's not that cut and dried, but I do think it would be durable. For example, a president can deschedule marijuana from the list of controlled substances and effectively legalize it. If that were done, and already right now, without that federal directive, 1 in 3 Americans live in a state that has legalized marijuana, that every time it's on a ballot, it passes, even in places like Mississippi and Alaska. And I just think there would be a high degree of positive support for descheduling,
right,
such that Jeff Sessions type of president that came after, who's paranoid about everybody getting high, would not be able to muster the political will to reverse that. So it really depends. I mean, my point is that if you make progress for people, if you're showing people tangibly what the power of government is, then you put the successor, who might not agree with those positions and philosophies,
in a defensive
really
posture
position politically.
Yes. Yes. So for instance, on marijuana decriminalization, at the very least on a federal level, it's very much the cows are outside the barn already type of situation. But,
right.
But something like DACA, I mean, we have seen, I mean, maybe Donald Trump was not, his administration was frankly just lacked competence, a competent, equally as cruel, administration might have had more success in shutting down
right.
that program.
They didn't do it well with the administrative procedure, and that's why they got nicked at the Supreme Court. I mean, I think on something like DACA and on a lot of these things, it's like if you go ahead on day one and change the policy, then there's going to be 4 years worth of that policy being in place and delivering benefits
right.
to people.
Facts on the
and
ground.
So you know, at least 4. And so if a President Cotton comes in 2024 or 2028, he's now swimming up against the tide of these, in the case of Dreamers, living in the country,
right,
able to thrive, being part of communities, being part of workplaces, and not there, not being really a substantive problem with that. So that, I think, makes it more difficult to just reverse the policy.
Right. So this is also about creating facts on the ground and providing, I mean, as a political matter, and I know this isn't really necessarily the point of the, really, you know, the project that you had over at American Prospect, and people can go find that. In terms of like relieving people's college debt, do you think that there would be a, as a political matter, some problem with doing that without having established some mechanism to provide at least an option of debt-free college for people going forward?
I think this is an area where you can see the potential of the Day One agenda as removing legislative gridlock as well. So a President Biden on Day One could say, student debt has become an intractable situation. We have $1.6 trillion. It's hurting our economy. Kids aren't allowed, or, you know, recent college graduates aren't able to buy homes, buy, you know, start businesses, buy cars, just participate in the economy. So we have to do something about it. I have the ability to do a mass cancellation of student debt, and I will do it within a year unless you guys in Congress come up with something that reduces this burden permanently and keeps it away, so that people have a chance to go to college if they want and not have it be like a mortgage that they have after they leave school and graduate. So, you know, then the tables get turned there, right? I mean, instead of Congress doing everything they can to avoid this solution, they now have to come up with one, or else, you know, at least from Republican perspective, they're going to have to live with a mass cancellation event, which is, you know, something they say they don't want. So I think that's the way you can think about this, is that the Day One agenda can also be a forcing event to get Congress to actually get to work on some of these things.
And let me add that I would say, as a strictly as a, you know, pure politics matter, if Joe Biden announces on, you know, February 1, 2021, that that's his plan, and says to Congress, I give you a year, and if you can't come up with something, or you cannot augment what I'm going to do, then that's on you. Then you have a situation that Democrats seem to rarely find themselves in, where the Republicans are in, under pressure every single day, right? Like, I mean, obviously, it's not an intense pressure, but every day that passes is a day that they are not doing something, as opposed to, you know, maybe they will get to do something later. It is they are ignoring a problem that has a timed solution. And that dynamic in and of itself would be a radical departure from the dynamic that we saw, you know, during the Obama years. I mean, the Obama administration even failed to do that in the context of the Supreme Court nomination, right? Like they did it almost backwards. Where it was like, here's Merrick Garland. We put him out there. The Republicans rejected him on day one, rejected the idea of holding a hearing for him, not necessarily on day one, but pretty close. And then that it was like, okay, it's all over now. All the air is just, we're letting all the air out of the tire. That's all. The tire popped, and now the air just slowly leaks out, and that's it. As opposed to some type of deadline, like if you don't hear Merrick Garland, then in 3 weeks, I nominate someone else. And then 3 weeks after that, I nominate somebody else. And then 3 weeks after that, I nominate, so that the story gets embedded into the news in some fashion, rather than just being allowed to dissipate.
Right. Yeah. And that's politics. And certainly, you know, the role of the Day One agenda, I think, is more policy focused and more focused on progress. But you can see how it can be wielded as a political tool as well.
Right.
And, you know, as they say, good policy makes good politics. And I think that, you know, the challenge of not just Biden, but the Democratic Party over the next 2 to 4 years is to show the American people that they have earned their trust. You know, my view of the election is that there were just enough people who just were sick of Donald Trump that they were willing to get rid of him, but that nobody trusted Democrats with full control of the government to you know, work their will. And the only way that you're going to regain that trust is by showing the broad mass of the public that you understand the economic pain that they're going through, and that you're going to try to you know, make it better. And there are items in the day one agenda that would serve that purpose. And it's frankly not just sort of a nice to have, but I think it's kind of a must have in terms of what you have to do to make sure that Democrats are seen as the party of the people again.
So, as a from the perspective of people who of people who listen to this show, and for people who, you know, like, what, how much, let me start with this question. How much of what you've laid out do you think was really, how much of it is, you know, basically just there's a certain amount of ignorance amongst maybe like the administration and its advisors, or that it's like, well, we're not getting pressure to do this. There's a certain amount of political capital that we have to expend on doing it. And so if we're not getting pressure about it, then we can just sort of pretend these levers don't exist. Like, where on that spectrum do you think past administrations or this future administration, I mean, lie? And then how do we move it into then, you know, with that assessment, how do you then force the administration to perhaps not even adopt the specifics, but to adopt the awareness that they can do these things?
Right. I mean, you know, just this week, the Biden transition team put together a series of agency review teams that go into the federal agencies and understand what is happening in them and what policy recommendations they should have. And there are hundreds of people, all experts on these teams. And, you know, there's a vast amount of knowledge about the federal government that every administration has prior to taking office. So it's not ignorance. I think the ignorance was maybe on the part of the general public who did not, you know, if you look at the way that the media covers elections, they cover them by asking questions about the vast legislative agendas that various candidates have.
Right.
They have really no control over
right.
whether or not Congress is going to pass them, unless you believe in the sort of bully pulpit idea of Lyndon Johnson, you know, putting his finger in somebody's face and making sure that something gets passed. But all of the discussion in terms of campaigns is about what, you know, what you want to get passed. None of the discussion is about what you can get done without having to get anything passed. And that's a real failing, I think, of the way that we cover campaigns. But the end result of that is that the public doesn't know that there are all of these possibilities out there because they largely just go unmentioned. And now, of course, that we have this situation with a likely scenario of a Republican Senate and a Democratic president, now you see these news organizations scrambling to say, yes, you can do this and you can do that, and here's what you can do on climate, and here's what you can do on immigration, and so on. But it's not embedded sort of in the way we think about politics. It should be, because of the number, you know, the exhibit A of this is Donald Trump.
Right.
I mean, Donald Trump only passed one significant law in 4 years. That was the tax cut. And yet he transformed American society in numerous ways, in immigration, in trade, in foreign policy, in healthcare, and so on and so on. He gave billions of dollars to farmers using a New Deal era program that was put together by FDR. It's, you know, there was a certain creativity there to get done what he wanted to get done and to use the powers of the office to do it. And that has not really held in past Democratic administrations. And so one of the purposes of writing the day one agenda was to really let these presidential candidates at that time know that we understand what you have at your disposal. We understand that the presidency is very powerful and that you have many, many options for what you can do. It was in some ways to counteract a theory that was put out there during the Obama presidency, particularly by self-styled wonks, called like the Green Lantern theory, yes, of the presidency. This idea that it's foolish to think that a president can just conceive of something and then will it into being. It was a way to denigrate liberals who were asking for more out of Obama, saying that his hands were tied and legislative factors played in to frustrate his aims, when in fact that was a severely limiting kind of theory. Yep. It had nothing to do with the administrative policy that all presidents have. And so I was pushing against that narrative and also letting candidates know that we know what you can do. And now that we have someone in the White House or coming into the White House that has that capacity, that claims to be a Democrat, we're going to hold you to it.
Why do you think it is that dynamic exists? Like, it's possible maybe there was pieces like this at Breitbart in the run up to Donald Trump taking office and like, hey, we know that you can, make our laws much more harsh towards immigrants, and you can get rid of refugees, and we know that you can divert money from the military to build a wall.
Right, Sam, who's the person who would write that article? His name's Stephen Miller, and he's just setting policy inside the White House.
Right.
Right. I mean, that's the difference, is that the thinkers that consider this stuff are directly embedded in the White House in a Republican presidency. At least in Trump's presidency, there was a lot of creative thinking going on about how to accomplish goals if the Congress frustrates you. And they even had a Republican Congress for the first 2 years. So the difference is that when Democrats get in office, they don't seem to have this kind of
level of thinking.
Although I will say that Biden has certainly been talking more about executive action prior to entering office than, any Democratic president in my lifetime.
Do you think that hesitancy by Democrats has been an ideological one, or do you think it's one where there's a perception of a fear of empowering the president too much, and that Biden's had a different perspective on this, basically, because we've just watched the Republicans, flip over the chessboard, as it were. And then you're like, well,
right,
why am I following the rules on the chessboard when they basically just take a bat and smash it?
Right. I mean, I think that Democrats are afraid of their shadow, and they are afraid that if they actually wield power, that they'll get criticized for it. And they look more at the criticism and the potential criticism than at the benefits you would get by actually wielding power. Certainly, there will be a lot of pushback to this if some of these measures are carried out. Republicans were yelling about Obama's czars, right? I mean, they were yelling about all kinds of stuff and calling him a dictator. Republicans are going to yell no matter what you do.
If you're
weak or if you're strong, they're going to claim that you're a tyrant. So what is the cost, right, of actually delivering? That's kind of the way I see it. But Democrats have this we gotta find the sweet spot. We can't go too far.
Right.
We gotta trim our sails. And it's nonsense. I mean, it just doesn't make sense, given the political landscape and the media landscape. I think they should go for it.
All right. So lastly, let me ask you this, broadly speaking, to the extent that we're aware of who's on the transition team, to the extent that we're aware, I know that you guys over at The Prospect have reported that Janet Yellen is looking like he's going to be his choice for Treasury Secretary. And that Ron Klain is looking like the pick for chief of staff.
Yeah.
Are there other names or are those names? I mean, that you associate let's just put aside, or, you know, I mean, if there's some that you hear that are very problematic, tell us. But are there ones that you hear that you feel might be more amenable to this disposition towards exercising power that exists within the presidency?
I mean, that's a good question. I would hope that anyone who is privileged enough to become a cabinet secretary and to run a federal department would want to use it to the best of their ability to carry out the mission of that department. And whether that's the Labor Department and all of the things you can do to help people save for retirement or to help workers make their workplaces more safe, or if you're in Treasury and you want to reinterpret tax law to make sure it's you know, everyone's paying their fair share, I would just hope that you would be wanting any and all ideas as to how to carry that out. And I don't have specific names really in mind of like, here's the day one agenda candidate,
right,
for these cabinet agencies, but my belief is that all of them should be.
It's interesting. I wonder if the democratization of the media in some fashion, okay, and by that I mean, you know, social media, it is helping, broadly speaking, the left to create an awareness of these things. I think in the past, the Republicans have had the advantage, or I should say the conservatives have had the advantage of having outside resources, so that if someone was an insider of sorts, they could actually step to the outside and not worry about being outside the loop, because there was enough outside resources, the Koch brothers, the billionaires who would fund their own agendas in competition with the Republican Party, and having that institutional memory and awareness and savvy function from the outside would put more pressure on a Republican administration. And I wonder if there isn't a version of that happening on the left on some level, because I talked about this on the Majority Report when we were talking about personnel. This is not a conversation that I feel like there was people on the outside were savvy enough to have even 10 years ago or so.
Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, there's definitely just a much greater awareness of the importance of personnel and the opportunities for policy progress without legislative progress. So, you know, just on Wednesday morning, Sunrise Movement and Justice Democrats put out this document about what they'd like to see in terms of policy and personnel. And they're like choosing possible nominees for the head of the Council of Economic Advisers, right?
Right.
It's like, you know, that was not a conversation that any kind of progressive organization would have. Data for Progress put out like a list of 200 or so possible candidates for all a host of different cabinet and even sub-cabinet agencies. Really a critical work that's being done on personnel that, you know, I feel like is the culmination of a years-long project by a bunch of folks on the left. So it's definitely, there's a greater level of sophistication here and a greater understanding. And, we'll see. Hopefully that'll translate into some positive results.
Indeed. And I would say that's also going on, not just in, you know, sort of policy. It's also happening on the judicial side. We have that demand justice,
or,
I think it is.
Demand justice, yeah.
And that is a that is also a recent new development, as it were. Well, David Dayan, folks can go to the American Prospect. They can find the day one agenda. I think you have a heading for
it.
On
we have two sections now that are good to look at. One is day one agenda, which has its own site that has, you know, all of our J1 agenda items. And that's at prospect.org/day-1-agenda. We also have a
very catchy URL. Very catchy URL. I would just
thank you very much. Thank you very much. So this one's just as catchy. We have a new section of the site called Cabinet Watch, which is looking at personnel. And that's over at prospect.org/cabinet-watch.
David Dayan, I would encourage people to go there, check it out. And, you know, I don't know, just let people know online, frankly, that they're aware of what the president's powers are, because just that general awareness puts pressure on the Biden administration. David Dayan, as always, a pleasure. Thanks so much for your time today.
All right. Thanks a lot.
David Dayan is the executive editor of The American Prospect. His work has appeared in The Intercept, The New Republic, HuffPost, The Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, and more. Hey, folks, an addendum to that interview with David Dayan right after we got off the phone to discuss the day one agenda. The Prospect launched dayoneagenda.org. That is dayoneagenda.org, dayoneagenda.org. Go and check it out and spread it around. Send it to your friends and, I guess, family. Hey, that's it for another week of Ring of Fire Radio. Thank you to all our free podcast subscribers who took the time this week to decide to support the show by becoming members. If you are one of those people who want to help the show out, head over to rofpodcast.com. It is your membership that makes this show possible. Don't forget, you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. And check out my daily show. It's called The Majority Report. Head over to majority.fm for my daily live stream covering all the biggest news stories of the day. I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire Radio.